Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note, this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Rachel Newsom. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Coronavirus in the U.S. Health System: System Inequities and Disproportionate Impact on Communities of Color. I'm Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund's a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. Today's call is part of a Commonwealth Fund Alliance for Health Policy series on the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, we'll focus specifically on the racial disparities in COVID-19 infections and deaths and what can be done to address these inequities. Panelists will discuss what data needs to be collected to better understand the disparate impact of COVID-19, how data can be used to combat the alarming trends we're seeing, and what policies could strengthen social supports and align resources for communities of color and ensure equitable access to COVID-19 testing and treatment. The pandemic will touch every corner of our health system, but we only have 45 minutes today, and we're going to be very focused specifically on the system inequities and the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on people of color. All resources from our discussion today and from earlier teleconferences can be found at the Fund's COVID-19 resource page on our website. I'm joined today by experts Lori Zephrin, Vice President of Delivery System Reform at the Commonwealth Fund, Bruce Siegel, President and CEO of America's Essential Hospitals, and Nancy Krieger, Professor of Social Epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We are thrilled that the three of you are able to join us today, and thank you for all that you're doing. As a reminder, we will take questions after remarks, but you can enter the queue now for questions by pressing star one. We'll start this conversation with Dr. Lori Zephrin on the disparities in COVID-19 deaths, where we're seeing system inequities, and the areas where policies can make a difference. Lori?
Great. Thanks, Bethann. And thanks, everyone, for being here today. So what we're seeing unfold in front of us is really a compounding of already existing disparities that are heightened when you add a pandemic to the mix. COVID-19 is resulting in many lost lives and fear, and this affects all of us in the global family. And in addition to the health harms, there's widespread economic and social disruption. And that disruption harms those of us most affected by inequalities, those most vulnerable to inequity. I mean, some people are referring to this as the crisis within the crisis. Released data from the Commonwealth Fund today reveals that when comparing COVID-19 deaths and cases in counties with higher or lower than average Black population, we see that areas with larger than average concentration of Black people have more deaths and have more cases. The results are stunning. Many people are sick with COVID-19, and death rates are higher in counties with a relatively larger Black population. So from the time COVID-19 has taken hold in the United States and community spread of the virus became known, communities of color have been disproportionately burdened by the disease. Communities of color face longstanding disparities, including disparities that affect health and disparities that affect access to healthcare services. And these disparities are a result of systemic inequities that affect where people live, the ability to access care, the social stresses that are experienced, and underlying health conditions. So it's really key to understand the conditions that perpetuate the disparities and frame the policy solutions to address these issues. COVID-19 is devastating, and really the time to act is now. So there are four things one can do from a policy perspective that can really have impact. One, we need better data, not only on testing, but on treatment and outcomes by race, ethnicity, language, zip code, and we need to require the collection and reporting of this data. I have a lot to say about data, but Nancy Krieger will cover the importance of that in more detail. Two, we need to be able to target COVID-19 recovery and stimulus resources to the most affected communities. Again, note that we can't target resources unless we have the data, and so those two are really tied in very closely. some resources needs to be directed in as terms of federal funding and also investment in infrastructure that put to community health centers, for example, and safety net hospitals that support the highest proportion of people most at risk. Bruce Siegel, I'm sure, will talk more about this in his comments. There should be resources going to providers and systems who are serving hard-hit communities. And we should think about these key principles in terms of where the resource is going and targeting the resources to the communities that are most in need. They really have to be central in how we allocate dollars. Three, we need policies to expand access and affordable coverage. That is foundational. We know that people of color are more likely to be uninsured. We know that being uninsured carries innate health consequences, and those most disproportionately affected by this pandemic must be able to access care and treatment. The federal government can take decisive steps to ensure expanded access to affordable health insurance coverage through reforms to both the private insurance market and Medicaid. And fourth, there are a lot of dollars being allocated, a lot of resources to stimulate the economy and support recovery, yet we are not done. These buckets of policy considerations we're talking about today are key to a comprehensive solution. And ultimately, really, there needs to be cross-cutting policies that reduce disparities, that promote equity in health outcomes. I mean, that must be critical, a critical part of any COVID-19 response or stimulus package. Health disparities are not a new phenomenon, and we really have to act intentionally to eliminate disparities. And that means data, data, data. That means we should think about how we allocate dollars. We should expand coverage and ensure that any policy or legislation that moves forward considers equity and measures the impact on communities of color.
Fantastic, Lori. Thank you so much. We're now going to turn to Dr. Bruce Siegel for his insights on the challenges and opportunities for providers in addressing both the resource constraints and making sure they can ensure equitable access to care for communities of color. Bruce?
Great. Thank you, Rachel, and privileged to be here. I'm going to talk mostly from the perspective of hospitals, but a lot of what I will be saying will apply to many other providers as well. The pandemic has really created unprecedented challenges for hospitals, especially safety net hospitals across America. They have been operational, they've been clinical, they've been financial. We've seen unprecedented demands on the workforce, certainly exacerbated by a lack of personal protective equipment, but also, you know, dealing with issues like childcare. What do you do when you have essential healthcare workers who need to be at work when the schools are closed? Or what do you do when, in one case in Detroit, 1,000 of your staff actually have COVID-19? So hospitals have been reworking thousands of processes, finding new ways of doing what they do, triage, revamping facilities. And the cost of all this are enormous. At the same time, while people have stopped coming to hospitals for non-emergent reasons, and when they've had to free up capacity to really be able to deal with the pandemic and also spare folks from unnecessary risk of exposure. All this is particularly threatening for essential safety net hospitals who are already disadvantaged and under stress, some with literally only days of cash on hand. These institutions care for the most vulnerable communities in America, communities where people already experience social risk factors like food insecurity and lack of affordable housing, where chronic disease is much more prevalent. These communities have been hard hit by COVID, which frankly shouldn't be surprising to us and which we should have seen coming. And now these organizations and their communities will bear the brunt of an unprecedented economic downturn. As of this morning, we know that over 26 million Americans have lost their jobs. We are talking about as much as a quarter of the workforce in some states. We expect a surge in the uninsured, especially among low-income people and people of color, people in parts of the country hit hardest by COVID. Millions will lose their coverage, and where will they turn? To the same places who are meeting the COVID challenge with the least resources, the Elmhurst Hospitals, the Jackson Memorials, the Harborviews. Without a broader social response, we will see even greater disparities in disease, disability, and yes, death. Now, to be clear, we were already seeing coverage erode in the United States, and that erosion will now be greatly accelerated. And what will be the impact as state budgets go into a tailspin as well? In the 2008 recession, we know what happened. Broad, deep cuts in Medicaid as enrollment surged and state budget tanked. So what's been the response? Congress and the administration have responded, sometimes haltingly. And I'll talk about provider support first. There was an increase in the federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP, which was beneficial to many safety net providers and certainly to the states. And that was a good thing to inject those resources into Medicaid and also probably a good thing for the economy. Then we also have now about $175 billion eventually in provider relief grants. The first methodology that was used was admittedly by HHS, their own admission, very flawed. It ignored the COVID caseloads in various parts of the country and ignored whether you cared for low-income and uninsured patients. HHS now seems to be trying to fix this in the next distribution and are also supporting rural and Indian health service providers. But the details are still not fully clear. And then there's coverage. There have been some relatively small bore things to fill the gaps, like creating an optional Medicaid eligibility group for uninsured patients for COVID testing and diagnosis, but not treatment. HHS is planning to allow hospitals to submit claims for care of uninsured COVID patients, which is not really coverage. Government health plans, government and private plans have been mandated to cover COVID testing, vaccines, and drugs without cost sharing. But there's so much that we have not done. We have not created a special enrollment period to allow the uninsured to get covered. We've not, as a nation, made it clear that those who have lost their jobs can enroll in the exchanges. And 14 states still have not expanded Medicaid. It's still a situation rife for helping to create and foster disparities. I was asked what the opportunities were. I'd say twofold, maybe, and there aren't that many, perhaps. The expansion of telehealth has been long overdue. That's a good thing. And hopefully some of that will stick after the current emergency. That'll depend on our policies going forward. The other opportunity, I guess, is that Americans are going to see how their social and healthcare safety net responds or not. And I do think that will spark a national dialogue on how we close the gaps and ensure the health and security of all Americans. Back to you, Rachel.
Thanks so much, Bruce. That was fantastic. We're now going to turn to Dr. Nancy Krieger to discuss how data will play a vital role in helping us capture the effects of COVID-19 and address social needs in communities of color and in low-income communities. Nancy?
Thank you very much. I'm extremely pleased to be on this call and to have a chance to speak with all of you. My standpoint is as a social epidemiologist who routinely analyzes U.S. vital statistics at the national, state, and local levels, and has worked on issues of documenting health inequities for a very long time in relation to a whole variety of different outcomes, ranging from cancer to in various infectious diseases, cardiovascular diseases, gun violence, police killings, you name it. So what I'd like to say is that the big problem here is that when you have no data, it means it looks like you have no problem. But that's clearly not the case here. And in the case of the United States, the data are inadequate to what they should be and inadequate to what they could be given the capabilities of CDC and also state and local health departments. So just to give you a very quick overview where things stand right now, and then to tell you about a working paper that we've just published, which underscores the urgency of getting the data properly reported. Right now, if you go to the CDC website, you will see that, for example, for the data that are on what is available by race ethnicity for state reporting, ostensibly 30 states are reporting race ethnicity, but that actually doesn't quite capture the story because for the vast majority, they're missing data on race ethnicity for more than 50% of the cases. When you don't know whose race ethnicity is being captured and whose isn't, you have differential selection going on, and you really can't properly interpret what those data mean. When you look at hospitalizations, right now the data on race ethnicity are missing on the CDC website for 65% of the hospitalization cases that are being recorded. So once again, when you have only 35% with race ethnicity, it's very hard to understand what's going on. Even so, on the very biased group that for whom race ethnicity data are available, it is definitely showing what would be expected that occurs with premature morbidity and mortality in relation to health inequities for many different chronic conditions in this country, and which is that you are seeing a higher proportion of younger people being diagnosed and being hospitalized among those with race recorded who are non-Hispanic black compared to non-Hispanic white under age 60, or flipping it around, among the non-Hispanic white over age 65 is 56% of the cases who's with race ethnicity that's been reported, whereas for the non-Hispanic black, it's only 28%. So you're not only talking about the actual burden, you're talking about premature mortality, premature morbidity, and then what that does to people and their families and their networks and communities, which is even more egregious. When you get to deaths, what's happening now finally is that the proportion with missing data on race ethnicity on the CDC website is finally going down. It was up to 78% last week. It's actually now down to about 5%, but that's only reporting for 19 states, or really 18 plus New York City. And so it's inadequate to have that level of missing data, and also the CDC website is set up in a way that it's extremely hard to understand what the disproportion is of what the percent of people are in different racial ethnic groups compared to the population in the area, in the state which is being reported. So there are huge gaps in the data, but these gaps should not be there. It is not difficult to have on a form, a digital form, as my colleagues and I have called for, to match exactly what is already collected routinely in the standard death certificate: age, sex, gender, race, ethnicity, educational level, and zip code. The zip code is not ideal, but it's better than nothing. Census tract would be nicer, but you have to geocode, so it takes more time. And to just give you a sense of what you can see when you start thinking about socioeconomic position in conjunction with race ethnicity, which is the clear way that data on racial ethnic inequities in health must be analyzed. You must both look at economic gradients within racial ethnic groups and also make comparisons within economic strata across racial ethnic groups. My colleagues and I have just published a working paper that we're in the process of getting in press, looking at first just by counties across the U.S. which are reporting any data on the COVID-19 death rate, and we actually did death rate, which is not the number of cases, but the number of cases per 100,000. If you go by the low to high poverty rates, the death rate is 9.8 per 100,000 in the low poverty counties, and if you go to the high poverty counties where more than 20% of the population is below poverty, it's up to 19. That's a huge difference. That's over a twofold gap. If you do it by household crowding, which is an incredibly informative variable that's available in the census, household crowding arises from the combination of lack of living wage plus lack of affordable housing. In the counties with very low crowding, the death rate is 4.8 per 100,000. In those with high crowding, it's 16.8. And if you go by population of color, which is similar to the data that Laurie Jessman was just reporting, but we combined everyone basically who is not non-Hispanic, not white, non-Hispanic. If the lowest quintile, the death rate is 2.9 per 100,000. In the top quintile, by population of color, it is 17.8. So this is egregious. And we then did the analyses at a more refined level, which is very easy to do with zip code, which has been made available in a very easy way to get from New York City. It's on a GitHub website for all the zip codes in New York City, and we replicated these kinds of analyses and show even sharper trends with a lower level of aggregation of geography, and then also the state of Illinois. Those are the only two that are putting out their data now at the zip code level. This is completely easy data to put out, and it is egregious that the data are not there, because, again, with no data, you can't document what the problems are, what the resources are, where the pop-up testing needs to be allocated so that communities with greater need get the testing that they need, also get access to protective personal equipment, and have the kinds of prevention and recognition of the kinds of care that's needed, and also where there will be more fear and more concerns about other health needs as well. For example, in Boston, they're now just beginning to do mobile vans to do childhood vaccination to communities where people are really scared to have their kids come to the doctor. And we can't afford to have more measles either. So these are the things that come together. It should be routine in understanding what the social determinants of health are. This is well established in the public health literature. It is not a mystery. That not documenting is an irresponsible act, and it is straightforward data collection that can be done at the local and state level and reported to CDC and should be mandated. So those are the kinds of comments that I have. I can offer many more insights onto what the data are, but I think that what we're trying to capture is at each step along the way, what is risk of exposure, which has to do with where you live and where you work? What is the likelihood, given that you're exposed to the virus, what is the pre-existing condition of your body in terms of already suffering from injustice and embodying it in terms of other forms of bad health, then what happens with regard to how severe the illness is? So all those things can and should be picked up by the health data that are collected and reported, and they need to be reported routinely and quickly. And the very last thing I'll say is that there is a bill that I am aware is being considered both in the House and in the Senate that is very aspirational with regard to what the health equity data are that are being called for, but it doesn't go into the nitty-gritty of actually how you get the data. And it is in the nitty-gritty of knowing how data systems function that you can ensure that there will be data so that you can get at what the racial ethnic inequities are as tied to socioeconomic position and racial injustice in this country, as reflected then and embodied in people's lived experience in COVID.
Great. Thank you so much. We will now open the floor to questions. Reminder, press star 1 if you have a question, then you will be entered into the queue.
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. And once again, to ask a question today, that is star and 1. And we will take our first question from Lynn Anderson with The Conversation. Please go ahead.
Yes, this is for Nancy. I was intrigued by this information about the number of people in the household. I've never heard of that before. You said it's collected via census. How can reporters access that information?
You can get that. It's in the American Community Survey. So what you should do for the American Community Survey data, you get, it's the definition of crowding, by the way, is extremely onerous in the United States. Crowding means more than one person per room, not counting the kitchen and bathroom. So let's say you have a one-bedroom apartment, and you have one bedroom, you have a dining room and a living room separate from the kitchen and bathroom. That housing unit would be considered crowded only if there were four or more people living in it. So crowding in the U.S. Census definition really, really is crowded. And it's a variable that's been there for a very long time. So it was used to be in the old long-form questions, but it's been in the American Community Survey, and it's just called household crowding.
Okay, thank you. Nancy, just if I could follow up quickly on that, you were also mentioning that the bills they're being talked about are not definitive in terms of, or not specific in terms of how this data can be collected. How can that change so that we can get more accurate and?
So the CDC
data?
The CDC does have a data collection form that's very detailed on its website. But from talking to colleagues, since it took over 30 minutes to fill out, apparently nobody's filled it out. So that's part of the problem. What we're suggesting is that to have a very quick digital form that would just get these key items, which would also match to what's in the death certificate, and that should be something that should be done at each stage of the process when someone is tested, whatever the test results are, positive, negative, which is a whole other set of conversations about sensitivity, specificity, false and positives and negatives, et cetera. But when that happens, when someone is hospitalized, and also then in conjunction with the death certificate. So it needs to be done locally, because the key thing is that CDC does not itself collect data unless it goes out and does a survey. CDC mm-hmm. gets data from the states. The states get data from all the right. locales. And the key thing to understand is a lot of people are looking at what is the national number. But especially when you have a infectious disease where local spread is what's key, is you need to know what's going on locally. Cities need to know. They need to know within their neighborhoods. Rural areas need to know for their areas. You need to have this done locally, which is why we're suggesting that as a crude level of geography, you could go with zip code, because anyone knows their zip code pretty much, and that you don't have to geocode that record.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you so much.
Question from Aaron Williams with Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, all. So my question has to do, I'm curious, this is for the whole forum, which do either of you have an understanding as to why the data wasn't collected or why there has been such a slow response? Like, was it just the fact that in the case of what Nancy mentioned, that the form was taking too long to fill out, or Was it some other factors at play? Like, why was there such a breakdown in trying to collect this information from the start, given that in a lot of other cases, this information is collected?
Nancy, do you want to start, and then maybe Bruce will have you weigh in?
Sure. I have been trying to find out the answer. I think that is an excellent question. I have been asking because it doesn't make sense to me as someone who has worked with public health monitoring data for a long time. I think that the reluctance to publish was in part because the data were so bad, because so much was missing. When you start off with the death certificate data and you're saying that you're the death data and you're saying 78% were missing race ethnicity, I mean, that's embarrassing. So I think that part of, I don't know why it wasn't being collected, and I don't know why it wasn't being prioritized. But these should have been routine, and I really hope that some investigative journalist finds out what the real story is.
So I'll add to that. I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's a great question. I will tell you that I worked years ago in trying to help hospitals collect this data on race, ethnicity, and language. That was a long-term undertaking. I think the good news is that hospitals came a long way on doing this, and most do it. But I will tell you, in the early years of this, say 12, 15 years ago, data was often missing. People were often reluctant to ask families or patients about their race, ethnicity, or language. People didn't understand why it was even important. So I think under situations where people don't understand how this data is used, and may frankly be reluctant to actually ask these questions and don't understand the importance of it, and with the general, you know, chaos and hurry going on, I guess I'm not surprised that a lot of this data might be missing. But that's speculation, mm-hmm. perhaps somewhat informed, but still speculation.
But I'll just jump in because, for example, I routinely analyze cancer registry data. Cancer registry data come from, are abstracted from hospital records, and they always have race ethnicity.
Or to ask a question today, that is star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll pause a moment to allow further questions to queue. And we will take a follow-up from Lynn Anderson with the conversation. Please go ahead.
Thanks. I'm sorry. I don't mean to hog the time, but I'm hearing impaired, and I just heard something that I heard that Nancy said that I didn't hear the first time around, so I wanted to make sure I understood it because it was a jaw-dropping statistic. Did I understand you to say that 78% of the death certificates did not have the race and ethnicity listed?
That was as of 10 days ago. Now it's dropped down for the U.S. total that CDC reported yesterday. It's dropped down to 5%. So they've done something to clean it up for the death data. But all that they have, however, is the data for the U.S. total, and then they have it for 18 states plus New York City. So it's not for the full nation. You can't get that data, and that's at the state level only. And it's not at the county level. And state level data are just that, at very right. high level of data aggregation, and they're not going to give you the information you need.
Right.
For localities.
Thank you.
Once more, to ask a question, that is star and one. We'll take our next question from David Molina with Pacific Six. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for having us. So one of my questions is that there is a lack of data. A lot of people, as you know, do not have the coronavirus or don't show any symptoms, and there have been a underreporting of deaths. I was just wondering what kind of data is there available to address some of these issues?
I mean, I can jump in again, Nancy Krieger. So with regard to the part of this is getting these data in real time is tricky. But the deaths, what can be done and what's beginning to be done was even just a big story in the Boston Globe today for my state, for Massachusetts, is comparing what the N of deaths are that have happened in the last number of deaths in the last 2 weeks compared to those same 2 weeks, for example, a year ago. So what that means that health departments need to release to be able to do that quickly and to do that locally is not only have those numbers available from last year, just even the total numbers. And ideally, it would be great if it were stratified by race, ethnicity, because that at the state level shouldn't cause any problems with regard to confidentiality, because there are real always concerns with public health data. You never want to compromise anyone's privacy. So that's a whole other set of concerns. But if you had those data and you could just report what the excess is compared to what it is last year, because you always have to ask the question, well, what's changed? People have been dying and will continue to die of cardiovascular disease, of different kinds of cancer, of diabetes, of et cetera. Those things are not changing that quickly. The amount people smoke cigarettes is not changing that quickly, for example, because people always like to blame smoking for everything. But what is changing very quickly, why do you have marked contrast of this year to last year? That's been done in a variety of European countries. It could be done much more effectively here in the U.S. So that means comparing the data for the same time period for the year prior. And obviously in the U.S., as the epidemic is moving through the population in space and time at different places, what you see is an excess risk in one place for the first 2 weeks in March. You're going to see somewhere else it's going to show up in the first 2 weeks of May, because that's when they get hit by their epidemic hard. So it's not a hard, it's about the using the right time frame to make these year-to-year comparisons.
And that
takes into account the seasonality of whatever else is going on, because, for example, there will be other coronaviruses circulating vis-a-vis what people get for colds, et cetera.
So I'll add a little bit to that, David. So New York City actually has adjusted its mortality figures looking at excess deaths. And so you'll see a large spike in mid-April that was reported in some media, and often you'll see that reflected in the footnotes. That was because New York used those methods to, you know, estimate sort of those uncaptured mortality. Similar techniques were actually used by George Washington University to try to establish the mortality from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. As you know, that was, you know, that created a fair amount of controversy. But I think most scientists think it was a fairly, you know, robust analysis. And, you know, it really, I think, opened our eyes to the magnitude of what happened in Puerto Rico with the hurricane.
And until there really is widespread testing at a sufficient level, you always have to ask the question, who's actually getting tested? To what extent is that because people are getting concerned about their own symptoms? And that's, you know, and those are people who are stepping forward on their own for the concerns about their health. Then there are questions about seroprevalence surveys that are going forward. So, for example, the NIH has posted that it's going to be doing a seroprevalence survey. And I have trying to find out what the protocol is going to be for that, because what I saw on the web was about contact with people by phone. And I also do research where you try to call people and get people to be part of studies. And you have to have certain techniques in place to make sure that you do oversampling to get people who would otherwise be underrepresented. And I think it would be really important for, again, investigative journalists to follow up and see what the protocol is going to be for this National Seroprevalence Survey to make sure that it's really getting the people, and particularly people from communities likely to be hardest hit by COVID-19, particularly low-income and of color, and potentially partly rural as well, to make sure that they're adequately represented. And the other thing is that if this national survey is to be really, really useful, it's got to be designed so it can give some local estimates. At least, you know, less than the state level would be ideal, because just coming up with a big national number really doesn't tell you what you need to do when you're dealing with a locally transmitted infectious disease.
Right. And just to add to those 2 points, you know, the policy levers are also critical as well. You know, really to be able to incentivize collecting, analyzing, and reporting the demographic data. You know, we need to talk about increased funding to state and local health departments through the CDC or other federal programs to support data collection and reporting.
Absolutely.
And also utilizing existing statutes that allow, that require collection analyses of reporting data on race, ethnicity, sex, language, disability, to the lowest geographic level possible. Because otherwise, having the answers to these questions becomes challenging, and thus, targeting the resources is going to be challenging, and ultimately managing the pandemic will be challenging for everyone.
We will take our next question from Amy Goldstein with the Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This question is for Bruce Siegel. Bruce, you had said that some of your member safety net hospitals, which are, you know, more financially fragile than other hospitals in the best of times, are down to days of cash on hand. And I'm curious whether your expectation is that the relief aid coming from Congress will be enough to shore all of your members up, or you're expecting that some hospitals aren't going to be able to make it through this?
So thanks for the question. I don't know the answer. I think that there are some who are very fragile. I would not be surprised to see some of them not survive this. I hope that's not the case. A lot will depend on decisions that, frankly, HHS makes over the next few weeks over, you know, how it allocates funds and how quickly it allocates funds. And a lot will depend also on just the duration of the emergency. I will also note that we have one thing we often lose sight of is that while this is happening, we are seeing the closure of critical access hospitals. We are seeing rural hospitals closing currently. So while the major urban safety nets haven't yet had that happen, although they may well, there is already been closing of some critical access hospitals, sometimes with links to sort of with what's happening with COVID. So to some degree, it's already happening. And for other hospitals, remains to be seen, but it's truly a real concern and something that we hope we don't see. I'll give you one example, I think, just to give you a sense of the magnitude. The New York City public hospital system has been really at the epicenter of this crisis. Many of us have read about what's happened at Elmhurst Hospital and Woodhull Hospitals and many other parts of the system. Their estimate is that this is going to cost them, the COVID-19 pandemic, about $1 billion by the late summer. So far, in the funds distributed by HHS, they have received $45 million. So that gives you a sense of the mismatch between the resources that have flowed so far to safety net hospitals, including some in the most hottest of hotspots, versus the challenges and the gaps that they face.
Question from Liz Kowalczyk from the Boston Globe. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much. I have another data question for Nancy. This is a little in the weeds, I guess, but Nancy, can you just explain a little bit more about how the race data normally gets to the CDC and what is exactly missing here? I mean, I'm assuming that for people who die of COVID-19, their race still gets recorded on their death certificate, just like it would for any other type of death. So what's missing in the process that would normally be happening?
So that's where I do think that why the death certificate data has changed. The death data has changed from being 78% missing last week to this. So the question is what the states are reporting and how quickly they're pulling the data together. The data theoretically should exist, but the way that it works is that the state is what transmits the data. So you have to look at what the state's doing and how it's pulling the data together quickly. And that's separate from the question of who's being called a COVID death right now versus who will probably later be also considered a COVID death. So it should be there, but what's happening is that normally those data are reported on a much slower basis. This is trying to get data much more quickly because of the crisis situation. So normally you would have states clean up their death files and, you know, they would show up at CDC the next year. And if you look, you will see that there's always like a usually year to 2 year lag and for some of these kinds of data. So part of it is about trying to get the data so quickly and have the pieces there all together. So I think that's part of what's going on with the death data. With the other data, hospitalization and testing, with testing, it's because the form is not being used. The data are just not being collected. This is a new form. This is a new test. And so it's so there could have been, had there been, for example, troop of pandemic preparedness planning, there should have been an existing form that was reasonably short that people knew could be used that could be mandated to have gone with all tests, but that clearly didn't happen. So people aren't reporting that. That those data are just not being gathered. So it may be a problem that can be fixed going forward. It's unlikely unless there can be record linkage of finding out who eventually got hospitalized, but it's unlikely that that test result is going to be able to get linked to any hospital record. Hospital records can also, it just takes time and effort to make sure they pull the data correctly from people's charts. And so that, again, I think if you're looking at the kind of shortfall that was just being described for some of the key hospitals that are caring for patients, you know, usually the resources go to taking care of people and not taking care of the data.
Thank you very much.
Once more, to ask a question today, that is star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll pause another moment to allow further questions to queue.
This is Rachel. Bruce and Lori and Nancy, I wonder if you might just take a moment. Lori and Bruce, you both mentioned the role of coverage and the importance of coverage as a foundational piece here in the COVID fight. And Bruce, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about kind of the role of Medicaid and other safety net financing sources for particularly hard-hit hospitals or communities.
Sure. Medicaid is really the backbone of the American healthcare safety net. So if you look at, say, the hospitals I mentioned earlier in New York, I believe about 70% of their revenues that keep their doors open come from Medicaid, either through regular Medicaid payments or also those disproportionate share hospital payments or DSH payments that are also critical to these hospitals. We went through a major expansion in Medicaid in America with the Affordable Care Act. Unfortunately, given the Supreme Court decision and, what went on at the state level, though we still have 14 states who have not expanded Medicaid. And I, frankly, am very concerned about those states, mostly in the Southeast, and how, their health systems will be able to respond to the COVID emergency as this continues and goes forward. We also know that many states, many local governments and municipalities also, help to finance these places, but really Medicaid is sort of absolutely key. One of the things I think that is important about the Medicaid program, despite some of the challenges it faces, is that it's also a counter-cyclical program. Like unemployment insurance, it's something that kicks in times when the economy is contracting, and that's a good thing. It actually, helps to, weigh against and move against those forces that are actually, leading towards recession and leading towards economic contraction. It actually injects resources into the communities which are around the providers who get Medicaid. I can't tell you, just looking at our own membership of hospitals, about 300 around the country, how often these hospitals are the major employers, are the major economic anchor for these very vulnerable, underserved communities. And Medicaid not only allows the people in those communities to continue to have access to those services, it frankly allows more economic vitality to actually exist in those communities as well. So it's about health, but it's also about the economy.
Thank you so much. Lori, maybe I'll ask one other question, Lori. How much of what we're seeing is driven by kind of urban versus rural populations? Or, is this discrepancy in some of the data you started with really driven by race? Or is there an urban-rural situation happening here as well?
That's a great question. The data that I referred to doesn't go into that level of granularity. you know, Nancy, you may want to add in terms of the data that you've looked at, adding to it. I mean, a lot of what we are looking at in the data that I talked about is just sort of looking at counties that have a higher than average population of concentration of Black people versus counties that have a lower than average concentration of Black people, and just really just see this, the differences in the number of cases and the mortality. And again, there just needs to be more data to better understand that, but also more ability to target resources to those communities. And I just like to add to sort of the Medicaid conversation as well, in terms of, you know, having policies to expand access to affordable coverage is truly foundational. And we know that being insured carries innate health consequences. So in addition to the economic impacts, also the health impacts as well, and really ensuring that there's access to coverage. Because we know that with Medicaid expansion, the research that looks at Medicaid expansion states versus those states that haven't expanded Medicaid, we see differences in disparities and access to coverage and access to insurance.
Rachel, I want to also just
mention
one other thing in response to your question. Thank you. And hopefully I got your question right. You know, certainly there are, you know, rural and urban divides here, but there are divides, I think, that are much more subtle there about where people work, you know, how it's transmitted at work, and, you know, as we're seeing in some of the, you know, food processing and meat processing plants in the Midwest now, they're having really remarkable outbreaks. Or, you know, again, using New York City as an example, even within, you know, the great urban sprawl of New York, there are very profound disparities of race and ethnicity, often rooted or at least going along with geographic disparities. So the borough of New York with the highest incidence of coronavirus, of COVID-19, is also the poorest borough, and that's the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parts of Manhattan, which have the most health facilities of anywhere in New York and perhaps some of the most in the country, are the areas of the least incidence of COVID-19. So the disparities, they're widespread, they're ingrained, and I think they're driven by a number of factors, you know, often very nuanced and often about, you know, where people live, but also where they work.
And this is Nancy Krieger, just to add to that. We actually use an additional measure that I've developed, which is a measure of racialized economic segregation, and it really helps you understand the phenomenon to bring together the concerns about both racial and economic inequities and how they get combined in this country. And that cuts across rural-urban differences in terms of even what was just said about, obviously, gross disparities within a huge urban area such as New York, but also within Chicago, et cetera. But the other thing that I want to make sure doesn't get left out of this conversation is that there is data coming out about, which, again, show the connections to both histories of racial injustice and also economic inequity, is what's going on with Navajo Nation right now, which is getting hammered by COVID, and also among American Indians in Oklahoma, and what's happening in tribal areas as well, which may often get called rural, but that's going to be, it's a very different kind of rural than other rurals. So I just think it's really important to pay attention to what the histories are of the different areas and the health statuses of the people in those areas as tied to the conditions in which they have been living and working in this generation and also the one before.
Mm-hmm. And there's also one last point also to your question, Rachel. You, in terms of the data that we're looking at, it's also communities that have larger populations of Black people. And so if we're looking at rural communities, if we look at those rural communities that have a higher concentration of Black people, then there's just a significant impact in those communities. And so Albany, Georgia is an example of a rural community where there's, you know, a high percentage of Black people and where the rates have been skyrocketing. And so it's really critical to when looking at the data to really dive deep and just look at the disproportionate impacts.
Great. Thanks to all of you. Lori, I want to let you have a closing remark and then we'll close it out.
Sure. I mean, again, I think this conversation really underscores just having a framing of health equity is critical to understanding the disparities that we're seeing. Thank you to Bruce, and thank you to Nancy for all of your perspectives and expertise. You know, this pandemic is really highlighting the need to address these issues head on, and it's really important that any policy or legislation that moves forward has to consider equity as its framework. We need to understand where the resources are being targeted, who they'll impact, and how the outcomes will be based on targeting those resources. So really just data is critical. We need to mandate it. We need to require it, both the collection and the reporting. We have to think about really how we allocate the dollars. So it's going to the communities and the people that are most affected. We need to expand coverage and ensure that, again, any policy or legislation that moves forward measures the impact on communities of color.
Thank you, Lori. And thank you again to Lori Zephrin, Bruce Siegel, and Nancy Krieger for serving as our panelists and for all of you for joining us today. As I mentioned, this has been recorded. It will be available on our website along with the data that Lori referenced that is being released this afternoon. If you did have questions that we didn't get to, please feel free to reach out to us by email. We will be holding additional teleconferences around our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we hope that this one has been helpful. So thank you again for joining us, and have a great rest of your day. Stay home and stay safe. Take care.